don't think of automation of right as a time saving technique. It's a transfer of knowledge. Okay. If you know how to do an analysis by clicky, 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 clicking, I don't know how to do that analysis. But if you were to take the time to get the code to me somehow, then it's a way of you saying, this is everything you need to know to do what I can do. You're transferring knowledge to me. Because Crouch's Law is, I can be an idiot and I will make mistakes. This is, if you like, the premise of all of the software engineering practices that go on to follow. But Crouch's Law has a corollary, and that is you are no different.
Most of the time, or sometimes, engineers are not actually talented coders. So today, Mike Croucher will walk you kind of through I would call it a framework, maybe, how you can become a better coder. So Mike, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you, Yosef.
Can you give the audience maybe a bit of a background? Like, who's Mike? What are you doing at the moment at MathWorks? And yeah, what are you up to?
Yeah, sure. Okay. I worked at MathWorks for the last 3 years. Before then, I spent about nearly 20 years in academia. So I started off with a PhD in theoretical physics. But I was one of those PhD students that near the end of my PhD, my supervisor said to me, you're more of a computer scientist than you are a physicist, because I spent so much time writing code and not enough time writing papers and actually thinking about physics. And I think she was exactly right. That was the state that I was in. And so rather than going on to become a research physicist, I went and worked at the University of Manchester in computational support. So working with the high performance computing department, working with people that was teaching introductory Perl. I did an introductory Perl course way back then that I used to teach people. I taught MATLAB, I taught Python, I taught all kinds of things. And then over the years, I got more and more involved with what I call the long-tailed scientists. So that, what that means is sort of the vast majority of scientists and engineers out there, they're not coding experts, but they have to use coding. So they'll do, you know, a little bit of MATLAB or a little bit of Python or Perl, Mathematica. I did all kinds of different things. But it wasn't their specialism. And I would work with, like, helping them just improve a little bit more. Very often the reason why people would come to me is because they needed things to go faster. That would be the initial way that people would get started. And so I kind of did this kind of work for quite a few more years. I got involved with an organization called the Software Sustainability Institute in the UK. Mm-hmm. They pretty much exist solely to improve research software. That was why they were created back in 2010. And from there, I got a fellowship, from a funding body called the EPSRC. So I got a research software engineering fellowship, which I used to found the research software engineering group at the University of Sheffield. So then that was a group of people where all we did was teach people how to improve their code. We actually got funding to work on their projects with them and so on and so forth. That group's still going. It's going really strong. Doesn't need me anymore, so I'm quite happy about that. But at some point, I felt like it was time to move on. And I ended up at MathWorks. They said, how would you like to, all that great stuff you've been doing in academia, how would you like to continue doing it, but working for us? So that's why I'm at MathWorks now.
Very good. I also like the subliminal message in the background, like Python for MATLAB development in MATLAB. And I think the other book is the one from Steve Brunton, right?
If I'm not mistaken. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Data-Driven Science and Engineering. It's a fantastic book. So, there's a lot of different, what else have I got there? I've got Optimized C++, books on algorithms, linear algebra, Accelerating MATLAB Performance is just, you can only just see it here. Along with some of my old physics books as well, quantum physics, quantum mechanics, and so on. So you kind of get the idea. I'm a physicist that ended up coding and then over the years sort of end up helping advise people on how to code. So,
yeah, really cool. What I really like about you, Mike, in your presentations on YouTube that I've seen is you put a lot of memes in your presentation, but also a lot of anecdotes. And one of the anecdotes you talked about is kind of the Excel error that kind of changed history. Can you maybe talk about that Excel error and why it was actually crucial to kind of share code in the first place and actually share it with another team or department and work on that code?
Yeah, so that was one that, the talk that you're referring to is a talk that I started giving in about 2015 called Is Your Research Software Correct? And the sort of original thing that inspired that was I remember reading in the literature about a paper called Growth in a Time of Debt, I think, by two economists from Harvard called Reinhart and Rogoff. And this paper was a really big deal. It sort of helped form much of the economic politics of the day. People were using the results of this paper to justify austerity measures in various countries. I mean, not just this paper. It was part of the argument for justifying austerity measures and so on. And essentially what it said was, I'm just going to read this here to make sure that I don't make a mistake. They said that countries with a public debt of 90% of GDP or more tend to experience a slower growth rate than if you had less public debt. And so that led to people saying, so we need to reduce public debt. And so the story goes is that not long after the publication, there were a couple of students or postdocs, I forget who they are, unfortunately, who attempted to replicate the work of Reinhart and Rogoff. Because, you know, the mathematics and so on was fairly straightforward, the data was available, and try as they might, they couldn't replicate it. And so obviously they felt, well, this is because we don't know what we're doing. We can't replicate the work of these fantastic economists and so on. And so they reached out to the original authors, and they said, could we take a look at your data? And the authors responded. They said, yeah, here's our data and all of our analysis, because it was in the same thing. It was an Excel spreadsheet. And after just looking at it for a relatively short amount of time, they discovered that Reinhart and Rogoff had missed off data points. So they'd made a mistake in creating their Excel formula. And I don't exactly know what the mistake is, but you can imagine that it's on the line of, you know, when you drag down, you've got to take the mean of a column in Excel, and you just click and you drag it down. Well, imagine if you didn't drag it down all the way, you know, you missed off some major countries. And so you made it. So essentially then their analysis was incorrect because of what amounts to a coding mistake in Excel. And this apparently changed the results. So the actual data suggested, using their exact analysis, instead of a slower growth rate, it actually showed a positive rate of 2.2% instead of a negative rate of 0.1%. Since then, there have been lots of discussions and arguments and so on that go way over my head as to, you know, what this what the correct analysis should be. But what really stood out to me is that over the years, I've seen hundreds of engineers and researchers and so on make use of tools like Excel to do their research. And that's the kind of mistake that any one of us could have made. Certainly, you know, and these mistakes, Reinhart and Rogoff mistake was one that got caught, but imagine all of the stuff that's out there that didn't get caught. And then I kind of got obsessed with collecting this kind of story. So I started like finding stories of small and simple coding errors, the kind of thing that any one of us could make, but that had large implications. So, and from there, I then sort of tried to come up with, let's see if we can learn something from these stories to improve the way that we all do engineering and computational research.
One of the learnings probably be like learning to code properly, whatever that means. So what would be the learnings for you, Mike, maybe to the audience, like how to actually start coding. Why would we code in the first place? How do we automate tasks? Is it just simply for automation, or is there something else apart from that?
So going back to the Excel example, I think, you know, some people will argue, oh, well, they shouldn't have used Excel, because if ever somebody makes a mistake with a set of tools, then you'll always have some group of people that will argue because they chose the wrong tool, right? If somebody were to make a mistake and it was MATLAB, people will say, oh, it's because you use MATLAB. Oh, it's very funny. So some people will target your choice of tools. In this case, I think the mistake was they didn't make their, well, whatever data and code they did do, and in this case, that was all in an Excel spreadsheet, they didn't make it publicly available. And that means it wasn't available for scrutiny by anybody else. So the paper then was just an advertisement for what they did. There was no way for anybody to check their working. And if you then compare this to the way the mathematics community works, you can't publish a paper to say, hey, this theorem's true. We checked it. It's true. People, yeah. Nobody would accept that. They'd say, show us the proof so we can follow your line of reasoning. And only then would the mathematics community accept a new theorem, because you have the proof that other people can look at and reason over. But in computational work, in engineering and in other aspects of computational science, it's very common for us to just show the graph of our results. We don't show the analysis that went behind it in whatever tool it's done. And so I was sort of suggesting that along with the publications, you should also always release whatever code and data went behind making those results, so that if you have made mistakes, somebody can go and find it because they can read what you've done. I mean, of course, what I'm describing here is an open source approach, but this is a very pragmatic reason to do it. It's just saying, however you've analyzed it, just put your scripts out there, even if they're just Excel spreadsheets, just put them out there so other people can look at them. So being open is the first thing I think that you need to do. Whatever analysis you've done, make it available. And the way that I suggest everybody makes all their stuff available is to put it on GitHub. Every computational paper should have a GitHub repository or Bitbucket or, you know, whatever it is that, if you don't want to use GitHub for whatever reason. But put it out there in a form that you can attach to the paper so that other people can then look at it and check your work, see how you've done things, critically reason. And then when they look at that, they can then decide whether or not they agree with your assumptions. Because if you don't do that, then I feel that all you're doing is advertising what you think you did, rather than, actually, it's not science unless you release all the code and data. That's I guess what I'm saying.
Certainly. I probably assume there will be someone in the comments saying, well, Mike works for MathWorks. And well, MATLAB is known to be kind of a black box, let's say. It's not as open source as Python, for example, people would argue, especially engineers. How much does MathWorks do for kind of the open science or open source projects in that sense? Can you maybe walk us through some of the projects that you've worked on, which are open source / open science?
I think so that's a very big question. And we have to separate, I guess, what I've personally done with what MathWorks does, for example. I mean, certainly there's a lot of MATLAB that is black box, it's proprietary. It's, our sustainability model is to charge a software license. And because we have that sustainability model, that allows us to do all kinds of things that benefit the open source community. So one example that I'm not directly involved with, but colleagues at MathWorks are, we worked closely with the linear algebra community for many years. For example, you may have heard of something called LAPACK. So LAPACK mm-hmm. is LAPACK is essentially the fundamental library by which all matrix operations is done. So the LAPACK standard is written in either Fortran or C++, I forget now, but some language like that. And if you do, any kind of data analysis in any language, then that uses matrices, which is pretty much everything, sooner or later, you're going to be using LAPACK. You might not know it because if you ask your software to calculate eigenvalues, you know, you don't think you're calling the LAPACK library, but you almost certainly will be. And MathWorks have contributed to that project for many years. If you go to the LAPACK release notes, you'll see a shout out to some of my colleagues in development. It's like a big thanks to these guys. So that's one part of the way that MathWorks works with the open source community, is that there are open source libraries that MATLAB is built upon, and we contribute to those. And the reason why we can afford to contribute to those is because we have this business model of having people paying for licenses to use our software. But then at the other end of the scale, we've got open source software that runs on top of MATLAB. Okay, so you if you go to the MATLAB file exchange, you'll see a lot of, from the level of individual functions that have been written by people out there and handed over for free, right up to huge toolboxes that have been in development for decades that have got, thousands of lines of code and so on and so forth. And we help support the development of some of those as well. There's like a whole continuum of things.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So one of the things I really like about your presentation was you kind of invented your own law, which is kind of Crouch's law. First of all, what is Crouch's law in the first place? And then maybe answering the question of, we talked about quickly about, like, in one sentence, about automating by using scripts and code and whatever you use, MATLAB, Python, etc. And you suggest that you use high-level languages to kind of automate tasks or use them for knowledge transfer, which brings me to the question is, first, maybe explain Crouch's law. And then there's this movement in engineering going on at the moment, which is kind of like using low code, like this, I would call it black box approach again, like how we know it as engineers from Simulink, for example. You have boxes that you kind of connect with nodes, etc. So how do you differentiate between high level languages, low code applications, and what should engineers use at the end of the day?
Okay, there's a lot of questions there. So first of all, Crouch's law, the way that I like to set that up when I give the presentation is I say, okay, let's talk about Crouch's law. Now, my name is Mike Croucher, and I've created a law called Crouch's law. So how arrogant am I, right? And then I'll say, when I first gave this presentation to my fiance and said, this is what I plan on talking to the engineers. She stopped me and said, are you serious? You're going to make a law about yourself? It's the height of arrogance and so on. And then she saw what Crouch's law was and said, oh, fair enough. No, I think I completely agree with that. Because Crouch's law is, I can be an idiot and I will make mistakes. This is, if you like, the premise of all of the software engineering practices that go on to follow. But Crouch's law has a corollary, and that is you are no different. You or anybody else, we can all be idiots and we can all make mistakes. And essentially, the reason, it might seem like a really obvious thing to say, but when you start to introduce software practices, such as my favorite, which is version control, and then after version control, it will be applying testing. You mention these to some people and they'll say, oh, I don't need to do that because I'm really, really careful. This has been an argument that's been said back to me. I'll say, seriously, if if you believe that you're so careful that you can never make mistakes, then I can't help you, and I'm not sure anybody can. I think you have to have the error of your ways demonstrated to you by example, before you can actually change your working practices. So I go on to say, essentially, you have to accept that Crouch's Law is true. Because once you accept that, you then say, okay, given that, I can be an idiot and I am going to make mistakes, what can I do to mitigate that? What can I do to make sure that when I make the mistake, it gets caught as quickly as possible? Because, you know, science is a messy affair. And so is engineering to a certain degree, right? When we're doing something new, we stumble around, we make mistakes, we learn from those mistakes and so on. And so a lot of the advice that I've given over the years is pretty much find those mistakes as quickly as possible. And things like version control and unit testing and other software engineering practices help lead to that.
Yeah, we might go in a little bit more detail in a couple of minutes. And then I talked about kind of this high level language usage versus low code language. Why do you advise people to use high level language and then kind of write out the code? Is it also maybe a technique to find mistakes as fast as possible when you write out code?
Kind of. Using high-level language? Yeah, so really the advice there is, when I say high-level language, I mean something like MATLAB or Python or R compared to something like Fortran or C or C++, right? That's what I mean by high-level language.
Yeah.
And there has been research done that shows that it doesn't matter what language you choose to use, your average coder will write a certain number of lines of code per hour, per minute, whatever your unit of time is. And the fact is, you can get a lot more done in 10 lines of MATLAB than you can in 10 lines of C. Okay, so I'm saying, use a high level language because it's more productive for the programmer. Okay, so, and I can already hear all kinds of fans of other languages, of C or C++ in your audience getting upset by that. Since the explosion of these high-level languages, it's made many more engineers and researchers have been doing a lot more coding, right? Now, it's kind of democratized coding because you can do your programming in these high-level languages. You don't need to learn C or C++. And then to answer your question about low code, back when I first started giving this Is Your Research Software Correct presentation, the idea of low code didn't really exist, but we did talk about using graphical user interfaces to do your analyses. So people would they would load their data in, and then they would click around on the menus and say, okay, I want to take that column and I want to do a t-test on it, and then I'll take this and do some other analysis on it and whatever. And then they write down in their Word document, we took column 5 of the data and did a t-test on it, and so on and so forth. And the reason why I didn't like that is because I would say, how reproducible is that workflow you've just done? It isn't. And indeed, would give examples of how papers had to be retracted because people had used graphical user interfaces and had actually clicked on the wrong thing. So they wrote down, I did a t-test, but actually they'd accidentally clicked on something else. So the number that came out of the data was totally unrelated. It was so it would be interesting because you would have like people argue, statisticians argue over papers, would say, oh, they've taken a frequentist approach, they should have taken Bayesian, and all of these quite deep mathematical arguments. And it's like, dude, it's a lot worse than that. They're not even doing what they said they did because they made a mistake. They clicked on the wrong thing. They wrote down the wrong number. And so I sort of argue, how reproducible is a mouse click? It's not reproducible at all. You need something that you can share. And so when we then go back to the low code things, which is almost like a modern take on these graphical user interfaces, right? Because you don't have to write any code, but you can do a lot of analyses. I've got no problem with low-code solutions as long as there's some way to make it reproducible. And the way that the MATLAB does that is that you've got your graphical user interface, your apps, your live tasks, and so on. And you can click around, you can do the analysis. And then when you're happy, once you've got something that you believe in, you can click on generate code. And then you can share that code mm-hmm. as the reproducible artifact. So I think
that's really cool.
Yeah. That's really where I sort of come down on all of this. As long as there's something that you can share, that somebody could, given your input data or your input starting set of values for a simulation, they can take that and they can push it through something, whether it be some code, a Simulink model, whatever, and the answer can come out the other side, then it's fine. So yeah, I think
that makes a lot of sense, Mike. But then people would argue, especially what I see, I can talk only for the engineers, they might say, well, Mike, but time to execute the code, like I don't want to sacrifice the time to execute the code. What would your counter argument for that be? Like, should you actually optimize for time when you start to code, or like when you actually are an engineer and write code? Is that the correct way to see coding?
I see what you mean. Because some people might say these high level languages are slow compared to low level languages or whatever.
Yeah, so that correct.
Okay. Well, first of all, high level languages are getting faster all the time. If you look at modern MATLAB, for example, it's so much faster than the MATLAB of even 5 years ago, and it gets faster all the time. Mm-hmm. An hour of your time as an engineer is worth a lot more than a couple of hours of compute time. What's important is to be able to get something that's correct as fast as possible. And the high level languages allow you to do that. If speed is an issue, you can always optimize it after the fact. Even now, some of my work at MathWorks is to help people at high performance computing centers to optimize their code and so on. And a much more, if you think of a productive use of time, scientists and engineers will often send me some code that they've written that only they could have written. There's no chance I could have done it. I don't have the domain knowledge. And they'll say, this is slow. And many times I can make it faster, just like while I'm drinking a cup of coffee, I can say, oh yeah, seen what they've done. That's a common mistake that programmers make. Make that a bit faster, send it back to them. It's 10 times faster, it's 100 times faster, whatever. They go away learning a new technique. And it was a correct division of labor. They didn't, they did all the hard stuff. And then I just did a couple of tweaks at the end to help make it go fast. Another way of viewing time taken for programming is some people don't like to automate tasks that they do via a graphical user interface, because they'll argue, there's even an XKCD comic on this. They'll argue that, it took me 5 minutes to do it via a graphical user interface. It took me 3 hours to write the code to do it. So they'll say it's a waste of time. And my counter argument to that is, don't think of automation as a time saving technique. It's a transfer of knowledge. Okay. If you know how to do an analysis by clicky, 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 clicking, I don't know how to do that analysis. But if you were to take the time to get the code to me somehow, then it's a way of you saying, this is everything you need to know to do what I can do. You're transferring knowledge to me. And by working in that way, you can then start to use the talents of different members of your team, because I don't need you to go through, to take me through that analysis every time. You could perhaps send it to me and say, I need this to go a bit faster. You could perhaps send it to somebody else and say, we need to use a graphical user interface around this. You can start to separate things out. Writing code is a transfer of knowledge, not just a way of, an automation. It's a transfer of knowledge, not just a way of making your life faster.
And if we look into the future, or like the current stage, like how people using MATLAB would actually code when we go back to this point of accessibility and collaboration. Okay. Because when I recorded this MatGPT video, when you go to GitHub, you kind of use version control, as we talked about. You kind of have this little button there saying open in MATLAB online, which kind of goes back to more accessible, more collaborative. So how does MathWorks approach kind of these problems that you've talked about, Mike?
Yeah, no, I see what you mean. Okay. So I think if let's say your starting point is you've got a few MATLAB M files, or you've got a Simulink model or whatever, and you're using that and you want to start doing better. Okay. The first step in that direction, in my opinion, is version control. Always get it under version control. I could give a whole seminar on why I think version control is a good idea. Okay. But for now, let's just take it, think about one route, which is the accessibility. Once you start using Git, for example, with MATLAB, which is very straightforward these days, you can then very easily upload it to GitHub. And make it, once you've done that, your code is now available to everybody. Or you can keep it private and just make it available to people in your consortium of collaborators or whatever. You know, you can control the level of open that you are. So just by taking on board this one very important technique from software engineering, which is version control, you've automatically made your work open. Because it's on GitHub. You could then, if you were in a MATLAB context, if you wanted to make it more easily available to other MATLAB users, you can connect your GitHub repository to the MATLAB file exchange, and it will do this automatically. So every time you release something new on GitHub, it automatically publishes to the file exchange. And the reason why you want to do that is that when somebody in MATLAB clicks on the add-ons section in the MATLAB desktop, they'll be able to search, they search for whatever it is they want, and maybe they'll find your code. Okay, so already you're now more useful to other MATLAB users. They're more likely to use your code. Your code's more likely to have an impact on other people. It's more likely to be cited and so on and so forth. And all you've done to get all of this is start using version control. Okay, the next thing that we did fairly recently was we added this workflow that you mentioned, opening MATLAB online. So by adding now an extra badge to your GitHub repository, somebody that comes to your repository can say, this analysis looks really interesting. They just click on that button. They don't even need to have MATLAB installed. Now it will open in MATLAB online in the web browser. They can use it. And so it's even more accessible and even more open. But you see, in order to make use of all of that good stuff, all you did was start using version control, and then everything else follows from that. So I kind of like say, if even one person watching this podcast were to contact us afterwards and say, yeah, I wasn't using version control before I saw you guys, but after this conversation, you said it so many times that, okay, I started using it, and here's my GitHub repo. If even one person does that, I'm going to be like super happy because, I think all the good stuff stems from using version control. And then there's several other much more advanced workflows that then, stem from that. But already, all you've done is start using version control. You get your stuff on GitHub, and lots of other stuff comes almost for free just by doing that.
Yeah. One thing I want to ask you, Mike, is more like we talked about knowledge transfer, which I really like the idea of actually not using it as an automation tool, but more like a knowledge transfer tool. Let's talk maybe about a mindset shift that maybe has to happen, because a lot of people think, well, it's my IP. It's kind of I studied for several years. I'm an engineer now. I don't want to share my intellectual property with other people. Like, what do you think an engineer has to go through in terms of a mindset shift to actually be more open and more collaborative in that aspect?
Well, I mean, of course, there are always times when you need to protect your IP sometimes. It depends in what domain you're working in, right? I've got very little experience with working in industry. All of my experience has been working with the academic community. Even now, in MathWorks, I specialize in academia, in research mm-hmm. and in teaching and so on. And in the in the academic space, what matters in the UK, I can't speak even for other countries, but what matters in the UK is we have this idea of research impact. How much impact did your research have in the world? And it's when you're actually writing research mm-hmm. grants for many of the funders, you have to write what's called a research impact case study. If my project is funded, this is how it's going to change the world. This is the impact that it's going to make. And I think that by making your analysis, your algorithms, and so on, putting them online on GitHub and making them open in this way so that more people can use it, you're more likely to get that impact. Okay. And so I think really that's how I think you should think about it. If you're working in industry and there are other reasons why you've developed your algorithm or whatever, you haven't, it's not part of research, it's part of like something that you're working on to produce a product or whatever, then perhaps you behave in a different way. I like to say you should be as open as is sensible for what you want to achieve.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Makes absolute sense to me. We talked about the version control right now. One of the anecdotes I have when writing my master thesis, for example, when you use frameworks like TensorFlow, whatever, sometimes the dependencies change, for example. Are there some other things that you encounter on a day-to-day basis, maybe even students, where you could give the listeners to the podcast kind of tips on maybe how to fix the issue with changing dependencies, virtual machines, containerization, for example, a few tips that you could tell the audience of what they maybe should explore if they want to become better coders?
Yeah, so dealing with dependencies is a big problem, as you say. And I think that it's one that hasn't really been solved fully in any language. In MATLAB, to a certain degree, things are made easier by the fact that if you were to say, I used, release 2023B, then you've already, I've used release 2023B on a Mac, then you've already set down a lot of your dependencies. That's a fairly well defined there. It gets more complicated when mm-hmm. you start using some of the open toolboxes, from the file exchange or whatever, because then you have to think, which version of this have I used, which version of that have I used. Similarly, like in, my fiance uses R a lot because she's a statistician. And, one of the issues that she has to deal with is that all the packages on CRAN, they change like constantly. And if you've got a very large project that uses a lot of packages, then sometimes the project will run today and not tomorrow. But there are ways of managing that as well. And essentially all of these ways come down to making some effort to record what your environment is. What are all the different versions of all of the packages that you're using? And this can be, can then be automated in various ways so that you can say to somebody, not only are you going to run my code, but you're going to run it using the same set of packages that I ran, whether that be in Python or R or MATLAB or whatever. There are ways of doing that. And I think that's kind of like, if you're starting to depend on lots of other packages, then sooner or later you need to start thinking about describing your environment as well. And I think level one is, listing all the versions of the packages that you do in some machine readable way. I don't know if it's still around, but there was something called the MRAN, for example, for R, that it was done by mm-hmm. it was done by Microsoft, I think. There was a way where essentially you could set the date where you could say, I'm going to use all the packages that were, all of these packages, whatever version they were on the 8th of November 2023, they're the versions that I want you to download. You know, and it would take care of it all automatically somehow. And then you have, you know, similar systems in PIP for Python and, you know, MATLAB and so on. So that's like level one. Then level two is to think about is containerization. You know, if you need to do that, to a certain extent, you kind of need to. It's an engineering call. How deep down this particular rabbit hole do you want to go? If you're writing like a very small script that doesn't have many dependencies, then a Docker container is probably too heavy. You know, if you've got a huge number of dependencies, you know, across many files that you're collaborating on simultaneously with many people, then maybe it is the right way to go. And I think that just being aware of the options is the best that you can hope most people to do. You know, there's no hard and fixed way of saying you should always use Docker for this, and you should always, you know, just list your dependencies and use MRAN or whatever for that. I think you just need to be aware of the alternatives. What do you think? Did you mm-hmm. agree with that, or do you think there's another way?
How I usually have done it is just list all the things that I've installed with pip, for example, in my master thesis. And then if someone would like to use the code, they kind of have a list of what they should install, kind of a requirements.txt file.
Exactly.
I guess, yeah. I think that's the, yeah. I think that's the most straightforward way. Any other tips that we missed? What do you think about a code buddy, Mike? Is it more for students, or do we even see that happening in the industry? I'm not sure if that's actually a thing in the industry, having a code buddy.
I see. So, okay. So, yeah, again, in that presentation, I came up with a list of pieces of advice for helping mm-hmm. make your research software be more likely to be correct. And one of them, I said, get a code buddy. And what I mean by that, what we would say in industry is code review. So in industry, we do code review. Okay. And so, for example, mm-hmm. at MathWorks, anybody that works in development, there's a formal code review process. You know, so a developer will write something. It doesn't end up in the code in the MathWorks code base until it's been reviewed. I don't work in development. I don't know what our code review process looks like. But I have, you know, worked in various places that have a code review process. And it can be it can be quite stressful, and also it can be a very formal process. But in the context of research, I say, let's take the idea of formal code review and just make it a bit more informal. And so what I mean by that is you essentially send your code to somebody else. Say, hey, Bob, Jane, whoever, will you take a look at this? And then just see what they say. And something that I've learned over the years is that you don't actually need to know anything about the subject domain to be able to say something useful. So if you were an expert in, I don't know, semiconductor physics or whatever, and you wrote a very long MATLAB script to do the analysis, if they then sent that code to me or you, we'd be able to look at it and we'd be able to say at least something. You know, it's like, oh, that's really weird how you, are you sure global variables? Are you sure? You know, and it is in my experience, when you let a second person look at your code, you end up learning something. And so really that's what I mean by a code buddy. Just send your code to somebody else and say to them, take a look at this and let me know what you think. And it's, yeah, so informal code review.
You've been coding for quite some time, Mike, right?
Yeah.
So you have been coding for quite some time, Mike. How do you personally do it? Do you also have a code buddy, or do you just say, well, I've been coding for a lot of time, but then Crouch's Law kicks in, right? Because you at some point will make a mistake. So how do you personally deal with it?
So I'm at MathWorks. I'm what's called a customer-facing engineer, which means pretty much what it says on the tin. I write code that doesn't go in the MATLAB product. I write code that demonstrates stuff for customers, or I work on customer code. And any code that I write, I'll share with other members of my team, certainly the demos. I still use code buddies now. Say, I wrote this, what do you think? And other people will look at it and they pass judgment. And I'm the author of the MATLAB blog. So I write code for the MATLAB blog. And it's for me, it's quite a scary experience because the head of product management at MathWorks has to personally approve all of my blog posts. So when you see any MATLAB code in there, it's been read by like the Jedi master of MATLAB programmers. And and she's picked out some real embarrassing mistakes in my code. You know, so I've written something where I've said, hey, audience of the MathWorks blogs, I've written some code that I really want you to look at. And it's contained mistakes. It's contained things that we should never advise. We should never advise customers to do. I've used deprecated functions. I've used terrible function names, all kinds of things, like some really embarrassing stuff. She'll come back and say, do you really not know this? And I'm like, oh, no, I didn't know that at all. So it's a humbling experience. But at the same time, the whole point of doing this is so that you don't make mistakes and that you learn something. So, yeah, even after doing this kind of thing now for 20 years, I still have code buddies. Almost every line of code that I write will get looked at by somebody else, even if that's a very informal, just scanning over it. It's almost always useful. So I'd suggest find somebody that you can have this reciprocal relationship with and do an informal swap of your code, definitely.
Yeah, that's a good tip, Mike. Thanks. You mentioned testing a couple of minutes ago. Could you quickly explain to the audience, because some of the engineers are not familiar, people listening to this podcast, what is testing in the first place and when and why do we need it?
Okay. So you've written a function. Let's say you've written it in MATLAB and you want to know if it gives the right answer or not. If you don't care if it gives the right answer, then you don't need testing. If you think that the right answer matters, then you need testing. Now, what typically people will start doing is we've all done this on the command line, right? We've written a function. We've got some ideas in our head about if I send the number 1 to this function, I'll get this result. If I send this data set to that function, I know I'm going to get this answer. And we do it manually. You know, we'll type the function in, we'll press enter, and we'll see if it gives the result that we expect. We've all done that at the command line. I guess you've done it too, right? And so all testing is, to a first approximation, is just automating that. You write your function out, you give it some example input data, and you make sure that the code gives you the output that you expect. I mean, there's a whole area of software development called test-driven development, where you write the tests first. You write the tests first, and then you write the code that adheres to that. I personally don't like that. I've got no good reason to say why I don't like it. It's just not how my mind works. There are tons
That's funny, Mike. You know why that's funny, Mike? Because my brothers are software engineers and they hate testing, like test-driven development. They hate it, but they never gave me a reason.
I can't give you a good reason. There are lots of people out there, I'm sure, who are saying, but test-driven development is the way to do software engineering. And I might say, yeah, it could be. It's just not the way my mind works. I sort of write the code first and then write the tests. And writing tests, it's a pain, right? Because you have to do extra work. And indeed, in most cases, you can write a really small function. So a small function that's like, it looks like this on the screen. And the tests, there's loads of them. It's a pain to do. But when you do it, it gives you... So it gives you the confidence then to start making changes, because you can make changes every time as you're refactoring your code and making changes. So have I broken anything? No, it's still all fine. How about now? Have I broken anything? No, it's still all fine. So it gives you the confidence to make changes. And indeed, some of my favorite projects to work on when I'm working with customers are ones that have got a test suite, because typically they'll come to me because they want some modifications made. And they'll say, hey, can you make it faster, for example? And I can then pretty much do whatever crazy stuff enters my head And I can say, right, I've done some really crazy stuff. I rewrote some huge sections of your code, but your test suite still passes. So we can be confident that I've not broken anything, even though I have no idea what it is you're doing. And then the next level of testing, if you like, is something called continuous integration and continuous development, which is where you combine testing with version control. So that's when every time you then update your code on GitHub, it automatically runs all of your tests and tell you whether you've passed or not. And so, you know, I kind of see that all of these techniques, they kind of add on top of each other. And then the end result is much bigger than the sum of the parts. It's always a really good thing to do.
Yeah, cool. Thanks for explaining, Mike. One of the last things I want to talk about, Mike, before we wrap up the podcast, is kind of overcoming challenges with MathWorks, like when you use MATLAB, Simulink, and all the other packages that exist out there from MathWorks. It's more like I talked to Jan and Heather about this kind of this Python versus MATLAB battle. What can people expect when they use products from MathWorks, whether we talk about the products, the consultancy that's kind of included implicitly, the training, research, and which I personally really like, also the very strong and helpful community. Maybe you could talk to that a little bit more to the community out there who maybe want to try MATLAB because I haven't tried it yet.
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly, as I was saying before, the sustainability model of the MathWorks is that we charge a license fee. And that gives you access to our software, but it also gives you access to all of the math workers. The first stage of that is, you know, if you have any problems with installation or whatever, you can just email support or phone someone up and say, I'm having a problem and so on. Within academia, there's a whole team of people just like me whose role is to help academics make better use of MATLAB in teaching and research. So we've got a worldwide team of people where if you were to say, I'm at the University of whatever, we've got a MATLAB license, and I'm teaching introduction to optimization using MATLAB, and I'd like some advice on how to use it better, we'll be there for you. We can help you do that. There's all kinds of extra work that we can do. We write in research, we help support research projects. And so at the University of York, for example, which is one of the universities that I look after in the UK, we are one of their industrial partners on what's called a CDT, a Centre for Doctoral Training. And we wrote, when they were at the grant funding stage, we wrote a letter of support for them about how this project was, we thought it was really interesting what they were doing, how we wanted to support it, how we would help them out, how it was important for industry as well as academia and so on and so forth. So there are all different ways that we interact with the academic community. You mentioned this in connection with Python. Before I joined MathWorks, I was both a MATLAB programmer and a Python programmer for many years. I've got a lot of respect for Python. I know a lot of people in the Python community. I was at JupyterCon earlier this year in Paris. And it felt like a reunion to me because I knew loads of the people that were there. It was great because we were telling everybody about the new Jupyter kernel for MATLAB. So the fact that you can now run MATLAB in Jupyter. We've got a lot for Python people as well. You can use Python code in MATLAB. You can use MATLAB code in Python. I've got a seminar that I'm doing with my colleague, Maria Gavilan, later in November, that will be about using MATLAB and Python together. It's more about what problems do you have to solve. And there's usually something in the MathWorks ecosystem of tools that, that can help you do that. When people use MATLAB and Python in the same language, they're typically thinking about MATLAB as a programming language. But it's so much more than that. You know, it's also a desktop. It's a workflow tool. It's got Simulink. It's got Simscape. It's got code generation tools. You can write code in MATLAB and get them automatically converted to C and C++. And you know, this is used hugely in industry. And you can integrate it with all kinds of other languages, of which Python's one. So, you know, when I say MATLAB, I don't just mean the language. I think of the whole system of tools around it. Does that answer your question? I kind of feel like I've branched off all over the place.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I kind of want to talk more about the support system, which you kind of answered, Mike. So really appreciate that. To give this podcast, and maybe to wrap it up, kind of give it a more Shark Tank-esque vibe, I want to ask you, like, if people are not sure what programming language they should use, and you have to pitch MATLAB for a minute, so please go ahead, Mike, and tell the audience out there why they should use MATLAB over Python or other languages.
Can I not answer that? I really don't want to get into...
trouble?
No, I don't. And if we can, just not include that in the podcast, because I think that I really don't believe in language wars. And I think that anything that I might say there, use MATLAB and not Python because of this, is just going to cause an argument. And it's not a ground that I want to get into.
Any recommendations out there to the community, maybe some motivating words, how they should maybe take action for open science? What would your recommendation be, Mike?
Okay.
The last word goes to you.
Thank you. So my recommendation then would be, whatever language you're using, whether it be MATLAB or Python or R or whatever it is you use, start using version control. That would be my first piece of advice. Whatever it is you're doing, start using version control. If open science is your thing, get it on GitHub. Start making use of, you can start making use of some of the other technologies that I mentioned before, the connection to the file exchange, mm-hmm. the Open MATLAB Online, and so on. So yeah, I think whatever it is you're doing, version control. That's the beginning of all the good stuff. If you were just to do one thing, start doing that.
Mm-hmm. What would be your one piece of advice to actually become a better coder? Is it just practicing at the end of the day, or is there something else that you would recommend to the audience?
Practice is certainly part of it. Getting feedback from other people, so the code buddy thing, doing that as much as possible, would be a good thing. Try and get a mentor, if you can. And put your code out there. If your code is out there, it's on GitHub or whatever, and people start using it, they'll start finding problems. All code has bugs, and when other people start using it, they'll find those bugs and they'll report them, and you'll need to fix them. And they'll also start having suggestions. And by interacting with the community this way, you'll start becoming a better coder. And then you'll also find that if your project's interesting enough, other people will start contributing to it. You know, they'll look at the code and they'll realize that actually, if you did it this way or that way, then it would be better, and they'll start making suggestions. So again, it comes back down to, well, if you started using version control and you put it up on GitHub, you're going to start getting better. It's the first step to everything. So I'm just going to keep circling around that particular thing.
Yeah, it's probably out of some people's comfort zone, but definitely very good advice. I wish I would have done that earlier in my bachelor's and master's. So yeah, we are almost at 1 hour, Mike. Thank you so much, by the way, for being on the podcast. And maybe there will be a second part in the future about another topic. Who knows? But yeah, thank you so much. And then talk to you hopefully soon. Maybe via Twitter or LinkedIn, whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, cheers.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you so much. Take care.